Visit licensureexams.com and try our samples completely free of charge. Welcome, everyone, to our Licensure Exams podcast. My name is Stacey Frost, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Linton Hutchinson. We're both so happy that you could join us today. If you have a chance, please tell your colleagues who are studying for their exam about our podcast. We'd appreciate it very, very, very much.
So, hey, notice I'm in Florida weather here. Probably will go swimming later on today. How about you, Stacey?
Oh, well, I've got three layers of sweaters on. I'm looking around the house for the space heater. It's chilly. That's Michigan for you.
Yeah, really. Well, today we're going to take an in-depth look at ADHD, including the main criteria, key concepts, and treatment strategies. And towards the end, we'll take a look at a case study. So this podcast is geared towards mental health professionals who are studying for the licensing exam and want to better understand how to diagnose and support clients with ADHD.
Sounds great, Linton. So let's start by giving our listeners an overview of ADHD. So for starters, ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, and it's a neurodevelopmental disorder that interferes with daily functioning.
Now, whenever I think of ADHD, I think of a child, probably little Bobby myself, who can't sit still and is constantly running up and down the classroom. But there's a lot more to ADHD besides just hyperactivity, right?
Yes. So hyperactivity symptoms are most often seen in preschool-aged children. So the image that you've conjured up, Linton, isn't far off. But it's a common myth that ADHD always has this prominent hyperactive component. There are actually three subtypes of ADHD.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So
are all three of those indicated in the DSM-5 TR?
Yes. Yes, they are.
Okay.
So the three subtypes are hyperactive impulsive presentation, like the one you were just talking about, Linton, with the kid running around all over.
Right.
Number two, an inattentive presentation. And number three is a combined presentation where the client meets the criteria for both those inattention symptoms and the hyperactivity and impulsivity.
Right, right. And the main premises understanding and underlying ADHD are, one, that it has a neurobiological basis and differences in brain structure and functioning. Number two, it's a developmental disorder, meaning symptoms begin to emerge during childhood. Although this doesn't mean that it's only diagnosed during childhood, adults can also be diagnosed. Mm-hmm. Number three, symptoms cause significant impairment in daily activities. Everybody, and you, Stacey.
Oh, yes, I'm in the same camp as you, Linton.
Yeah, we have difficulty with attention, sitting still, or impulsive behavior from time to time. But to diagnose ADHD, the symptoms have to cause an impairment in functioning. Remember Rose, Stacey?
Well, of course I do. I came up with the memory device to begin with, Linton. Did you forget?
Well, now that you mention it, yeah, I guess, right, you did.
Well, Rose stands for relational, occupational, social, and educational. And these are all areas of functioning that may be affected by ADHD.
Right. And before I interrupt myself, guess what?
What?
It's quiz time.
Oh, sneaky, Linton. Sneaky, sneaky.
Okay, here we go. The main premise underlying ADHD are, one, ADHD has a blank basis and differences in brain structure and functioning. Two, ADHD is a blank disorder. Three, ADHD symptoms cause blank impairment in daily activities. Rose stands for
So ADHD has a neurobiological basis and differences in brain structure. ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder. Did I get that one right?
Yeah, developmental, right.
Okay. All right. And then ADHD symptoms cause significant impairment in daily activities. All right, cool. Well, thank you for that sneaky quiz and summarizing those key ideas there, Lyndon. And a quick side note here to build on that neurobiological piece was that individuals with ADHD have differences in certain regions of their brain, including the frontal lobes, basal ganglia, corpus callosum. I just love the word corpus callosum and cerebellum areas. There also appear to be neurotransmitter differences like lower levels of dopamine and norepinephrine. Now, anyone who doesn't speak cognitive neuroscience, can you elaborate on those parts of the brain control there, Lyndon?
Sure. I can speak to that. Well, actually, it sounds like a question for my daughter, Sterling, but I can't reach her right now. She's probably at Publix, but I'll give it a shot.
Getting that BOGO sushi, huh?
That's right. Wednesday. Oh, that's Wednesday. Wednesday is BOGO sushi. Yeah.
Get ready.
I'm ready. To begin with, those particular brain regions and neurotransmitters differences go a long way towards explaining many of the ADHD symptoms you might see in a client. The frontal lobes handle executive functioning like planning, prioritizing, and impulse control. The basal ganglia help filter distractions and regulate movement. Differences in those areas explain symptoms regarding organization, paying attention, and hyperactivity.
Right. Now, at its core, ADHD involves problems with two main cognitive skills: maintaining attention and self-regulation. So the attention skill set involves things like staying focused or shifting focused when you need to, like if you're having a conversation with multiple people or you're switching between tasks and blocking out distractions. And in the other arena of self-regulation, clients with ADHD might have difficulty controlling their impulses and managing their emotions. So people with ADHD often have a pretty low frustration tolerance, which can lead to irritability, impatience, anger, or procrastination.
You know, that sounds like a couple different diagnoses I can think of. So how would you differentiate between a diagnosis of ADHD and intermittent explosive disorder?
Good question. Well, let's give all you therapists out there a minute to figure that out before we give you an answer. And by the way, all of you out there, you will not be allowed to take in your DSM-5 TR when you take your exam.
What?
Yeah. You won't. It's not an open book test. So no textbooks, no books, no nothing allowed. So you best spend some time going over the DSM. All right. Time's up. ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder with chronic symptoms, while intermittent explosive disorder involves episodic aggressive outbursts. So both disorders can involve impulsive behavior, but for different underlying reasons. The impulsive behavior in a client with IED, intermittent explosive disorder, manifests as aggression, verbal outbursts, or destruction of property during episodes of rage. And it stems primarily from difficulties regulating emotions, especially severe anger, along with distorted cognitive processing related to perceiving threats and provocation. Impulsivity manifests with a client with ADHD as interrupting others, difficulty waiting one's turn, blurting things out, rushing through tasks, impulse shopping even. It stems
at Publix?
Yes. Hey, I would have trouble controlling my impulses on BOGO sushi day. So it stems primarily from deficits with inhibitory control and executive dysfunction in the brain.
That's true, but it also is important to note that ADHD exists on a spectrum. So symptoms can range from mild to really severe.
Absolutely. Excellent point, Lyndon. And the severity is really what drives the specifics of the treatment plan.
Right. ADHD is not a problem per se, but rather a difference that present both challenges and strengths. We're talking about some of the challenges, but the other side of the coin is the people who have ADHD are often really creative, energetic, and spontaneous. Let's get into the key concepts and theories around ADHD treatment and management.
Sounds good. So to start, a concept that guides treatment is this idea of ADHD as an executive dysfunction. And executive functions are thinking skills that we use to accomplish goals, solve problems, and handle new situations. So when we're planning, prioritizing, managing time, or paying attention, we're using executive functioning.
Right. And ADHD involves deficits in many of those specific executive functions.
Exactly. So treatment will often focus on strengthening and compensating for executive function weaknesses. And this can be done through certain medications, behavioral strategies, therapy, and creating structure and routines.
So two other key concepts about neurodiversity and biopsychosocial model are that the neurodiversity recognizes ADHD as a normal variation in how the brain works. The biopsychosocial model indicates that ADHD results from the interaction of biological, psychological, and social environmental factors.
And those are really important frameworks that shape how we view ADHD. The neurodiversity paradigm combats stigma and judgment, while the biopsychosocial model emphasizes ADHD is complex with multiple contributing factors.
Okay, well, Stacy, let's switch gears now and walk through some of the ADHD treatment and management techniques. And remember, your goal as a therapist is to match interventions to each client's unique challenges and needs. So when creating the treatment plan, you need to consider the following. You need to identify target symptoms and behaviors to address. You need to discuss medications and non-medication options. You need to explore lifestyle factors like sleep, diet, exercise, and stress management. You need to help the client develop organizational systems, and you need to help planning classroom or workplace accommodations, obviously depending on the age of the client. And why don't we take a minute to summarize some of the key terms and concepts we've talked about so far, okay?
Sure, yeah, that sounds like a good time for that. So attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, is a neurodevelopmental disorder characterized by inattention, hyperactivity, and or impulsivity. Inattention refers to difficulty sustaining focus on tasks, being disorganized or forgetful. Hyperactivity means excessive movement and restless energy. Impulsivity is acting without thinking, impatience, and interrupting others. Executive functioning refers to cognitive processes like planning, focusing, inhibition, and working memory. Neurodiversity is a view of neurological differences like ADHD as natural and as normal variations in the human brain.
That's great. Let's see now if we can apply this knowledge with a case study, Stacy. How about you walk us through a vignette and then we can talk about treatment approaches?
Yeah, sure. Sounds good to me. So here is a brief profile. All right. We've got a student named Jackson, who's a 16-year-old male, referred by his parents and teachers for an ADHD evaluation. He's struggling academically with poor grades, often forgets or loses assignments, and has trouble staying focused in class. His teachers report that he's easily distracted, frequently daydreams, and has difficulty following instructions. And on the home front, his room is a wreck, and he has trouble finishing chores or tasks like walking the dog or putting dishes in the dishwasher. His parents state that he often loses track of time and is always late to family activities. They also note constant impulsive behaviors like interrupting everybody and difficulty controlling his behaviors when things don't go his way.
Okay, well, thanks for the case studies, Stacy. So as a therapist, the first step you would take is to what?
Conduct a clinical interview.
Right, where you'd ask about developmental history, current symptoms, functional impairments, and things such as that. You would also gather rating scales from parents, teachers, and Jackson to qualify the severity of his attention difficulties, hyperactivities, and executive function deficit.
Okay, sounds good so far.
Next, what would you do?
All right, I'm thinking here that you're going to want to conduct a thorough assessment of his cognitive abilities, like working memory, processing speed, and cognitive flexibility. Mm-hmm. Does that sound, Linton?
Yeah, that sounds right, because that's helped identify any learning disabilities or other cognitive weaknesses typical of ADHD. You would then synthesize all that data to see if it met the DSM-5-TR criteria for an ADHD diagnosis. What would be some specific assessments that you would use?
Well, there are like a million and one assessment tools out there. So for ADHD and for our client Jackson here, you could use parent or teacher reports like the Connors rating scales and the behavior assessment system for children that measure the adolescent's inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity in school and home settings.
What else?
You could also use continuous performance tests like the TOVA, T-O-V-A, or IVA to measure attention, concentration, and response inhibition. You could do a psychoeducational assessment to assess for learning disabilities and academic achievement deficits.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are some self-report scales like the Brown Attention Deficit Disorder Scale, ADHD Adolescent Self-Report Questionnaire, and if our client were an adult, you could use the Adult ADHD Self-Report Scale, ASRS, to obtain a subjective symptom report.
Wow, that's quite a bit. There's still more. I mean, you could review the client's previous records, obtain previous diagnostic reports, school records, et cetera. It's also really helpful to collect collateral information from family members who possibly, keeping in mind the client's consent is important, mm-hmm. that would give you some additional information. And of course, part of the assessment process is to screen for other conditions that may be contributing to or complicating the ADHD symptoms. Like what, Stacy?
Let's see, depressive disorders, mm-hmm. Anxiety disorders,
right.
Substance abuse, maybe sleep disorders, you name it. There's several different things that can look like ADHD. So the goal is to use multiple methods and sources to get an objective, detailed view of the client's symptom profile and their level of impairment across those different settings, at home, at school, at work.
Mm-hmm.
And this informs diagnosis, identifies comorbidities, and will help guide appropriate treatment planning.
That really sounds like a pretty comprehensive assessment approach.
Yes.
If the results support ADHD diagnosis, how would you then go about to proceed with treatment planning?
So your first priority is going to be reviewing the assessment results with Jackson and his parents to educate them about ADHD.
Right.
There are a lot of misconceptions about ADHD out there, and I would find it extremely helpful to provide that psychoeducation about what ADHD is and what it isn't.
Right. You can never go wrong with psychoeducation. Okay. What's next? Well, then you would have a discussion about various treatment options, including a psychiatric referral to see if medication is an option. And you talked about non-medication possibilities as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes people are open to medications. Other times they want to know about what else, you know, what other options there are.
Finally, you would guide the family into exploring a 504 plan or an IEP at school. Ongoing coordination and communication between parents and teachers are going to be critical.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not familiar with a 504 plan, you probably need to if you're taking an exam, because it is a service agreement that provides accommodations for students with disabilities in the U.S. public school system. It derives from Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Which prohibits discrimination against students with disabilities. A 504 plan focuses on providing accommodations for a student's specific disability in order for them to access education. This can include things like extended times on test or specific seating arrangements in the classroom. Could that somehow apply to people that will be taking the exam for licensure?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the things on the exam is that you're not always going to be a therapist working in a private practice setting or an agency. You could be working in a school system. So some of your clients could be children in elementary school, middle school, high school, perhaps even college. So it's really important to understand these special accommodations for students in a learning environment.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So Linton, okay, thanks for explaining about the 504 plan. What about IEPs? We hear
right.
about that a lot too.
An mm-hmm. IEP is a legal binding document that outlines specialized instructions and services a student needs to be successful in school. This can include accommodations, modifications, and goals for academic performance. IEPs come from the Individuals with Disability Act, the ACT, or known as IDEA, IDEA, which is a federal law overseeing the eligibility of students with disabilities to receive certain supports, such as what, Stacy?
So there are a few big differences between a 504 plan and an IEP. Eligibility, scope, and what's included in the plan. So the eligibility requirements for a 504 plan are quite broad. So really, any disability that affects a student's ability to learn can qualify them, while an IEP is much more specific in its criteria. Now, as far as scope, a 504 plan focuses solely on providing accommodations for the student, while an IEP provides more comprehensive support than a 504 plan. An IEP covers all aspects of a student's education, including academic performance, behavior, and social-emotional needs. And finally, a 504 plan does not require specific goals like an IEP, which includes specific goals to support the student's academic achievement. All right, so we've hit all the bases here and discussing the differences between the IEP and 504 plan, Linton. Mm-hmm. So your treatment plan for a client incorporates therapy, school accommodations, and family support.
I don't think we told them what IEP stands for.
Oh, yes. What does IEP stand for? Quick quiz. And the answer is Individualized Education Program.
Right, right.
All right.
So what was your question again, Stacy?
So what would you focus on in your initial therapy sessions with Jackson? They kind of outlined our process through doing assessment with him, finally arriving at our ADHD diagnosis.
This is where the rubber meets the road. So early sessions would involve more psychoeducation about ADHD for the parents and how it might impact Jackson. Ideally, you would want to set small, attainable goals around organization and work on developing habits and tools like planners and to-do lists that would provide the needed structure for the client. Mm-hmm. Over time, you would equip him with strategies to minimize distractions, manage time, control impulses, and handle challenging emotions. You'd also be checking in with Jackson and others involved in his care and make tweaks to the treatment plan.
Nice. So any final takeaways to share before we wrap up this podcast episode, Linton?
Like many issues in life, there's no easy overnight fix it for ADHD, but with ongoing support, appropriate treatment, and lifestyle adjustments, positive change and growth is absolutely attainable.
Great. Thank you very much, Linton. And a big thank you to all of our therapists out there for tuning in and learning alongside us today.
Well, until next time, remember, it's in
there. It's in there.